The Movie Morgue podcast is made possible by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you'd like to learn more about how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/Kwasanim. You'll find a link to that in our show notes. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all,
wash it away, it will haunt you. Guys, gals, and non-binary pals, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess Whitmore.
And I'm your co-host and producer, Annie.
And today we're going to be cutting into Hobbs and Shaw, a Fast and Furious movie. I know that's not actually what they call it. I don't give a shit. Okay. That's what we're going to be getting into. And as always, we're going to be starting with context and talk about how we're coming into this movie. And Annie, if you could go ahead and start.
Yeah, sure. I really enjoy going to see the Fast and the Furious movies. When I saw the trailer for this one, I was super, super excited because I like the characters of Hobbs and Shaw. I think that they have this really great tense dynamic to play off of, and I think they're kind of funny together too. Jason Statham and The Rock have pretty good like on-screen chemistry. Then I saw that Idris Elba was going to be playing the villain, and I was sold. This looked really interesting to me. I'm also somebody who's kind of been on board since day one with the Fast and the Furious franchise. I have always really enjoyed these movies. I think that they are oftentimes kind of getting written off as the sort of like popular movies, and so therefore they must just be fluff, right? But actually, they're doing a lot of complicated identity work in the films themselves, talking about race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation sometimes. Not always well, but they're trying to talk about it.
Yeah.
Jess, how about you?
Well, I'll get to that in a second. I just want to ask, what's your favorite Fast and the Furious movie? I'm curious, like, where you stand on, like, the series as a whole. Like, where do you think it's really excelled and hit the formula, and where do you feel like it's, like, I'm curious, because I think, from my understanding, and we'll get to why it's from my understanding in a second, is that they take slightly different tracks, and I think some are... I want to know what you think to be, like, the platonic ideal of a Fast and Furious movie.
The platonic ideal. The basic Fast and the Furious movie plotline revolves around family relationships. These are found families. And around issues related to loyalty and trust. Typically, there's some kind of plotline going on with someone potentially being in law enforcement and betraying their chosen family's trust. And there's a lot of stuff involving cars and street racing as a way to gain entry into the group and the family. So on top of that, you're also going to have some truly ridiculous stunt sequences. These films are known for being like kind of meta in some ways. So that's kind of like the basic structure. In terms of a film that I think typifies that, I mean, you can't go wrong with the first Fast and the Furious movie, but I do think that Fate of the Furious is also a very good example of that plot structure as well.
Cool, cool. So for context, and the reason why this is from my understanding of the series is because I have watched none of these since the first one. Honestly, I don't even remember the first one. Although I will say I apparently have caught parts of them because I very distinctly remember The Rock bursting out of a cast and saying, "Daddy's gotta go to work." I remember that. So clearly I've seen some of this, but like I've kind of just been an outside observer for like the last decade or whatever it is we've been doing these, where it's just okay. Like, wasn't this about cars? And then you see all the trails, it's like, Are they an international gang of spies now? I don't understand
yes.
what's going on. And I've
yes,
heard a
are.
Lot of discourse around this franchise in particular, that it's about family, it's about found family, it's kind
yes.
of like the Avengers, but diverse, and there's yeah. like it seems to mean a lot to a lot of people. And I've actually been kind of curious to check it out since, like, the latter half of the franchise, where we stand today, where that discourse really started cropping up in my radar. But I never have, so... No, I have basically no connection. I don't know who any of these characters are. And I'm actually going to talk about that a little bit later on. But I actually, because Annie, you actually suggested I check out Fate of the Furious before this. And I checked it out and I didn't actually watch it. And I'm kind of glad for that, actually.
Okay.
So, Let's review this. And I think we want to start with me here because as the newcomer, I think my perspective is probably the most interesting.
I'm so interested to hear
what you have
to say here. So. I really am.
I will say this is a film that perfectly executes its vision. And for that, I give it an A.
Okay.
Now, here's the thing. The vision that it is executing is that of the film that a 14-year-old boy who is hopped up on Monster Energy drinks and just watched... Let me finish. Just watched Lethal Weapon and James Bond movies and really, really likes Metal Gear Solid 4 Guns of the Patriots. That is who made this movie, and that little 14-year-old boy is one of the greatest auteur directors of this century. So I give it an A.
Okay, that... That's a pretty great review.
What about you, Annie?
I don't think this one gets an A from me. It gets a B. I think that the screenwriting for Hobbs and Shaw is pretty great in terms of the dialogue between the two characters. Like, the tension between The Rock and Jason Statham is fantastic. They seem like two major personalities coming into contact with one another, and I think that's also true on set. And you can just kind of feel that crackling energy in the way they deliver lines. It's great. But I do think there are places in the script where it kind of lags towards the latter half of the movie, which it really shouldn't do, because this sets up this wonderful action sequence in this last third that's set in American Samoa. So I think there are parts of it that drag, but it really shouldn't have, and it also ends very abruptly. That kind of bugged me a tiny bit. So, yeah, I don't think that this gets an A from me. I think that it is as good as some of the previous films, but that the screenwriting could have been a little bit tighter.
I think that's kind of part of the appeal to me, and also I realize I did omit one element, because I've been thinking about this for, like, the last 3 days since I watched the film.
Oh, what did you leave?
The other thing that child loves is... Actually, no. The thing that his 7-year-old brother loves is Hot Wheels.
Oh, yeah. Hot Wheels. Man, I miss those.
Wheel away. But no, like... this is part of what really worked for it. Because, like... It does kind of straddle this really weird line for me where... It is both, I think, at times a serious film and at times absolutely self-aware and completely ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And I think you really kind of, like, it sets the expectation for that very early because, like, you have this kind of introductory action and everything's fun and you've established who these characters are and you've... And, I, by the way, can I say how much I love the split shot? With their, like, morning routines.
Yes. So
beautifully
good.
Done. Like, love that. Brilliant editing work there.
Mm-hmm.
But what it really kind of sells it for me, I think, is... And I think he's more important to this film than I think a lot of people are going to give him credit for. But Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, he's kind of a big bit
also,
of
is it just me, or has he, like, become... Has his vocal performance become more distinctive as time goes on?
No, it feels like he's playing himself in cameos and films now, which is fine, because this is the same director who did Deadpool 2. But then we also had Peter, who was also in Deadpool 2, who was the other FBI agent, I think.
I did not catch that, actually.
Yeah, that was him. So there's a little bit of cameoing going on, and it's great. It's quality comedy,
like,
moments.
I think that that kind of, like, manic energy that I really like in this film, where it's going as, like, okay, cool, but what about this? And this, it's like that kind of, like, this is that aesthetic of, like, the 14-year-old storyteller that I am absolutely all about. Because let me tell you something about this film. I did not give a shit about this film.
Mm-hmm.
I've been kind of interested in the Fast and the Furious franchise, but that's been more kind of an abstract back burner, kind of like, okay, maybe one day I'll do, like, we'll review them all on the podcast, and then maybe I'll, like, do, like, a marathon or something. Like, you know, it was something that I was going to get to eventually. It wasn't something that had any kind of urgency for me. And I saw the first couple of trailers, it's like, oh, there's this character, he's really cool. And here's this character, and he's really cool. And I didn't care because I didn't know who these characters were. But then there was one trailer that wasn't a trailer. It was just a cut. I saw, and I don't remember where I saw this. I think it might have been on YouTube or something. But it was just the isolated chase sequence with the Bugatti. With the Maserati.
Nope, it's a McLaren.
With the Maserati and Idris Elba and his magical motorcycle.
Oh yeah, that motorcycle and from Tron. Yeah, it's good
And
stuff.
When I saw Idris Elba slide under two trucks with his magical bike that folded itself to drift even lower,
yes,
I was like, oh, I need to see this. And also, yes, it was a good action sequence, and I was excited watching it. So that got me hyped to watch this. And basically, every element of this is really bombastic and really silly in a way that I don't think holds up to serious scrutiny. And that's part of the appeal, because I think if I were, you know, like a producer producing this and I didn't know the Fast and the Furious and I didn't, you know, trust it, like, eyes blind, if I were a producer, basically, you know, most producers, then I would go, this is kind of unrealistic and this is kind of, like, I would make it more boring by trying to make it more realistic and naturalistic and serious. And it doesn't, like, the whole, like, truck escape sequence is just, like, it's just, like, a big square block of a truck that just blows through everything. It's really silly. Or when they, like, chain up all the custom nitro-boosted fucking hot rod trucks together.
Yeah.
It's all goofy bullshit.
Yeah, it is.
It's absolute goofy bullshit. And, like,
this is why we have to watch the other
like,
ones.
You know, like, I can see, like, another version of this film. And I think this is something I do a lot on this podcast, as I look at, like, what this film could have been, you know, like, what different people's choices would make. But I love this choice because I think in, like, a different version of this movie, it would have been like, oh yeah, it turns out that, like, you know, the gangbanger family, turns out they're a PMC and they've actually got guns. Like, it'd be really silly. And then, like, that scene from the trailer would have been like, oh, you sold all the guns? It's like, nah, we're just fucking with you, bro. You were gonna go in there with a stick? Oh, you're so funny, you know? And so, like, this idea that they can, you know, like, drive a ring of fire around these PMCs whose guns they've disabled, and they're just beating them with, you know, traditional weapons is ridiculous. And I really don't think it passes muster of, like, structural storytelling, but that's part of why it feels so novel and it feels very different to other films that we typically watch. Like, we do a lot of action movies in this, particularly like the gunplay kind of things, and it's like compare this to something like The Raid, which, you know, like, we watched and then, like, we had to push that one back a bit, and it's just like, you would never have any of this. Like, these are diametrically opposed aesthetics of action.
They are diametrically opposed. The one thing that I'll say about this franchise, though, that I think I mentioned previously, these movies are very poppy. They are very bombastic and ridiculous. But at the same time, they are often using kind of like the realm of the popular to talk about these really complicated issues related to identity and family and negotiating your place in the world, and that's really cool to me. That's really interesting, and it's also really fraught, so there are trade-offs. There are things that are good in these movies, there are things that are not good, and they're kind of occurring at the same time, which makes them really complicated, but it also just, they're very fun. They have wonderful stunts in them. Jess, at some point we'll have to watch the previous movie because you have missed a just absolutely gargantuan submarine chase, which I think you will enjoy, and Tyrese using a car door to slide to safety. So there's some really fun elements, and there's some cool work in terms of the discourse going on in these movies, and that's why I like them.
That is absolutely fair. So I want to say this. How does this hold up as a sequel?
Spinoff? I'm curious. Maybe?
I guess it's a spinoff.
Yeah. Okay, so for that, I want to provide a little extra context in here because there's a lot going on. So in the previous movies, there's kind of a core group of people. There's Michelle Rodriguez, there's Vin Diesel, there was Paul Walker, rest in peace. And then we kind of have Hobbs and Shaw appearing, Jason Statham and The Rock appearing. And they wanted to make their own sort of like branch off of the franchise, and this caused a massive amount of drama within the sort of established group of people who had been in the previous movies. And that is really, really evident in the screenplay. There's a different dynamic between the two actors that was kind of there in the last movie, but is distinctive.
Okay, well, I don't know so much about that.
In terms and of whether this is a good spin-off.
I'm going to be real. That's kind of more what I'm interested in because, yeah. I'm not so much into the behind-the-scenes drama. It's like, I do think it's kind of interesting, but also, you've kind of said the piece about it.
It's actually important for you to know that that happened, though, because it explains a lot of the tension and the dynamic of these guys in this film. These are the two producers, The Rock and Jason Statham, for this film. They have clauses in their contracts that say they can't ever get beaten in a fight, so that shapes a lot of the narrative and the story that they're telling in their fight sequences. So much is going on with these two characters. This is a different dynamic. These are a pair of guys who are big personalities, whose personalities have kind of come into contact, and they're clashing. And it's a kind of frenemy situation as well as we got from the previous movie where there's this amazing jailbreak sequence with the two of them. So it's a different dynamic than the previous movies because it's not focused on a group of people. It's focused on two guys and, of course, Jason Statham's sister. So it's just a different dynamic.
What really surprised me for this was one of the things I was worried about going into this film without having seen any of the original franchise was that I wouldn't recognize characters and that this film wouldn't necessarily be readable without that kind of context. And one thing that I was very pleasantly surprised by was this film perfectly stands in a vacuum. They introduce Hobbs and Shaw very effectively, very cleanly, and it just works from them. I have no idea what elements are pre-existing and are brought back for this, and what elements are created wholesale originally for this film. And the fact that, is there any other significant things that you would say are drawn from the main series that I should know about?
I think that these movies are very formulaic, and that's part of what people like about them. But the formula for this movie is fundamentally different from the previous ones. As I said, it's more focused on a pair than on that original group that featured Dominic Toretto, because Dominic Toretto is kind of like the core family member who holds everybody together like social glue, right? This is also less about boosting cars or driving cars in street races. This is more of an action movie genre, like more in the realm of Red 2 than it is in the realm of, say, Tokyo Drift. It's not as focused on street racing or, the culture surrounding that, as a lot of the previous movies have been. They've kind of shifted more towards an action espionage type deal over the past few sequels.
Yeah, absolutely. So do we want to just go through performances real fast then?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Dwayne Johnson.
He's great.
Charming, as always.
Solid.
I will say, I think probably my favorite thing is him and the daughter.
Yeah,
that's very sweet. And I love the scene where Hattie's in interrogation. She's beating the shit out of that dude, and he can't see it, and the daughter can't see it because the angle is too high.
Yeah,
and I love that, and it's very sweet. I don't really it's not really this really technical or creative decision that I think anyone's making, but I think it's just a point of natural connection between, and it's just chemistry between actors. And I feel especially compared to how quippy and quick and clean his lines are with everyone else. His dialogue for a lot of this film feels very calculated. It feels very scripty. It's very punchy. But with this was 3 days ago, and I've been up for like 18 hours.
Oh, what is the daughter's name again? Sam.
Yeah. So like the chemistry between Dwayne Johnson and Eliana Sua is fantastic, and it slows down the pace of the film, which I really like.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I see like a lot with child actors in particular is there's a tendency to overscript them and overdirect them to the point where they kind of don't feel like children anymore. And one performance that I want to compare to, actually, that I think is kind of an odd comparison, but I feel is appropriate here, is the little girl from Tarsem's The Fall, where there's a natural energy and exuberance and kind of like childhood wonder that is an energy that I think other actors picked up on and they're allowed to react. Now, I don't think that, you know, she was given the same free rein and the script is improvised around her. This film is entirely too overproduced for that. But whatever it is that they did, whatever they did in directing and in producing and editing, they gave her space to breathe. And that really reflects well with other characters who interact with her. So, like, Dwayne Johnson gets really great moments with her. Ryan Reynolds gets some good moments with her. And you can see a difference between when he's talking with the three of them and when he's talking just with Dwayne Johnson. So that, I think, is an important thing that I just kind of want to call attention to. Like, that's probably my favorite part about this performance. Even though, like, I love The Rock being like, yeah, you know, snappy, I'm going to hit that guy, and, like, being a big, tanky, beefy guy and talking shit with Jason Statham. That's great, but that's also just what's expected. I'm not surprised. I'm not impressed. I'm also just, like, not wow. I'm not overwhelmed. I'm not underwhelmed. I'm whelmed. And, yes, I am stealing jokes from Robin, for God's sake.
Oh,
boy. What have I come to down to? I don't know. What do you think of Jason Statham in this one, Annie?
You know, I've really enjoyed watching Jason Statham do more comedy-oriented stuff of late. He was also in a movie called Spy, which is just a hot mess, but he is kind of funny playing a parody of himself. I think that Statham has this appeal that's sort of midway between these different martial arts actors where his style calls for this very dry sense of humor that's really kind of Guy Ritchie-esque, but he also has the martial arts capabilities of somebody like a Jean-Claude Van Damme. And he just has this really, really solid interplay with The Rock. And, you know, I don't want to assume things about these guys based on their contracts, because their contracts, like I said, said that they could not lose a fight to one another. That might just be their agents. But I do think that they bring these two personalities that are really pretty big personalities to life in this story. And I think it works really well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, Annie, I think this is our first Jason Statham venture. And I wanted to run a thought by you because I've said this about Jason Statham for a while now, probably a couple of years. Because I think you touch on kind of how he's vibed and how he's cast in various projects. But I don't think you're quite on the money here, because what I think he is he is the American Jackie Chan.
Interesting. Okay. All right, I'll bite, but explain. Explain.
Because particularly one scene that I think of, and what I'm not saying is that he perfectly captures the energy and kind of aesthetic of Jackie Chan. What I'm saying is he is an American approach to a similar problem. And one scene that I think of in particular was, I believe it's from one of the Transporter movies, but it's the one where he's fighting on an oil slick, and so he straps, I believe, bike pedals to his feet so he can, like, fight, like, with clogs in an oil slick. And it's that kind of improvisational, situational, environmental fighting that I think kind of separates...
Yeah, like innovative choreography.
I think that's what separates him from being just a straight-up martial artist.
Okay.
Or being, you know, more of this kind of classical, you know, white, bald, gruff guy on every video game cover
okay.
kind of character.
Okay, I can definitely see that, especially since so many of Jackie Chan's movies made for American audiences focus heavily on physical comedy. And Jackie Chan is an amazing physical comedian. He does a lot of stuff with pranks, a lot of stuff with, you know, like near hits and misses and stuff like that. I can see that. What I think is going to be the issue here is that Jason Statham is his own sort of unique brand of this. He's a mixture of different sort of archetypes within the world of martial arts films. And so I do still feel like the stuff with Van Damme is kind of accurate because he is sort of this gruff dude at the same time. He's got a mixture of different things that he does at different times.
I think this is an interesting conversation to have right here, though, because I still think... I don't necessarily like the comparison to Van Damme, because while Van Damme did have funny moments, I don't think that's kind of where he lives in, like, the iconography of my mind. Because when you, I think of Van Damme, I think of some of his earliest stuff, like, you know, Bloodsport. And when Van Damme, I think, came to prominence, at least in my mind, there was much more of a focus and much more of this kind of optics of being a serious martial artist and of doing martial arts film. So in a way, I think, like, Statham has never quite had that. I don't think, like, that aesthetic necessarily applies to him. So I think that's why, at least in my mind, this aesthetic of him being this kind of, like, improvisational, kind of more expressive and sillier and funnier fighter kind of comes from. Because when Van Damme goes campy, I kind of see that in more like, you know, in the later part of his career, and it's something he leaned into. It's more like, okay, cool, I'm gonna do the splits in every movie now. When, you know, you compare that to his earlier work where he's like covered in blood and he's doing the kumite and he's screaming and like punching guys, like there is a disconnect. And I think that kind of like imprints on me initially as like that's where I think Van Damme went and had to kind of reconfigure himself afterwards, whereas Jason Statham, I think, has been in this mold from the beginning. Also, he's got, I mean, yes, okay, Van Damme has his accent. That's fair. He, you know, he's French.
He's Belgian.
But Statham's accent, he's always had that deadpan. Like, I've always feel like, because, like, I think of Statham, I think of stuff like Crank.
Oh.
You know?
Okay. Yeah.
Like,
where the plot's just, like, absolutely ridiculous. Like, yeah, I mean, Crank is very hyperbolic. And I can totally see that, especially with some of Chan's later works where the plots are ever more like Byzantine and ridiculous. I totally get that. I do think, though, too, that Statham has been really influenced by Guy Ritchie on top of, you know, Jackie Chan, on top of Jean-Claude Van Damme. He has said before that Ritchie is the person to whom he owes a lot of his career. And I think his style of dialogue, his sense of humor, I see a lot of that reflected in how Statham carries himself and talks. Absolutely. In this movie.
And, we spent a lot of time on Jason Statham, and I think this is just because, like, Jason Statham is an actor whose work I really appreciate, and I'm trying to think of, like, an actual role he's had where he's, like, a stone-cold badass, or where he actually tries to lean into, like, that kind of optical or that aesthetic of, you know, combat for combat's sake, like actual intimidation. And I can't really think of anything, because even if you go for something like, you know, The Expendables, where everyone's like these cool badasses and he's like, ah, he's the guy who throws the knife and stuff, like there's still that element of playfulness to that character. And I really can't think of a time where you could compare him to early Van Damme.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily specify early Van Damme, but this is one of the complicated things about Jason Statham. I think he's a very multifaceted performer, and I think that gets overlooked a lot because people underestimate martial arts, or actors who can do martial arts or who do a lot of stunts. Jason Statham, I think, pulls from a lot of different sources. There's definitely some stunt choreography that he's done that's very reminiscent of Jackie Chan's physical comedy style, which I personally really like a lot. I think he also, I can tell in the way that he holds himself in fights, it does look very similar to me to how Jean-Claude Van Damme does. In terms of his sense of humor, though, I get a lot of Guy Ritchie from him. And I think that's partly because I've seen him in Snatch and Revolver, so I've already seen him in those roles. I've heard how he delivers the lines, and I've seen, you know, like, how Richie frames the action. And I can see him pulling from, you know, like, that repertoire, from that persona that he had in these Guy Ritchie movies. And I think Idris Elba does that to a certain extent as well. And it works. It works. And I think it creates a multidimensional character.
Absolutely. But yeah, Idris Elba as Brixton. I love him. He's very self-serious, and it's kind of adorable. But also, like, he is at times very... Like, it's a weird balance to strike in that I can both, like, really respect him seriously as a villain, but also, like, he's just kind of silly sometimes.
He is just kind of silly sometimes, and it's nice to see because you can kind of tell that he sort of has a sense of humor, not just about the role, but about the movie. Like, this is a very poppy blockbuster film, and he's definitely playing this sort of villainous archetype in the film. But I think he brings a lot of dynamism and charm to this role, which I think also makes him a more intimidating villain because he's so compelling. He's somebody who I really like in a series called Luther, as well as Pacific Rim. Obviously, he was great in that. This is just a really great role for him. And also, that motorcycle, the chase sequence with the McLaren. There are so many good sequences with him that are just like, yeah, this was really good stuff in terms of that motorcycle. I really do love that motorcycle.
I'm sorry. It is the dumbest thing in this entire movie. And I'm including the kind of Hot Wheel chain of custom semis. Like, yeah. it's so dumb, but it kind of works.
Yeah, which is also a great summary of some
One thing
of the
I will say is that aesthetically, I really like the kind of cohesion of the whole, like, black tactical supersuit. But one thing that I really like is the kind of, like, contact lens HUD he has, particularly when it glows and you can see it externally. Like, that's a very striking image. It very much to me, I think, evokes, like, you know, like, his role as Heimdall. But it gives him a very intense gaze, which, you know, he already has. It's Idris Elba. The man is just yeah. fantastic.
It's even more intense.
It's just that little bit of extra spice that just pushes it over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
I will say one thing that I really... One thing I found kind of interesting, and I... This is, like, a weird thing, is, like, the... is it Enoch? The tech company... thing?
I can't actually remember the name of the tech company, which is hilarious because I should.
Shadowy tech place, whatever. One thing scene that I actually found strangely compelling were his enhancement scenes, because there's a couple things going on there. One is he's first of all showing pain and weakness where he's very stoic and unflappable throughout a lot of this film. And also you're seeing him in a different power dynamic, because in every other scene, he's asserting power over space. He's commanding underlings. He's basically displaying complete superiority and mastery over Hobbs and Shaw when he's fighting them. And to the point where they're doing a running retreat while they're combating him. But in those scenes, someone else has power over him. And I think that's where you see a little bit of nuance to his character, in that's where you see a completely different dynamic. And there's a little bit of resignation and sadness to the character. You definitely see that coming in with the kind of ending they have for him, where he just gets burned and thrown out by his organization. But you know what I was kind of expecting to happen, actually? I was honestly expecting that he would actually explode and self-destruct, and so that, like, I was expecting him to... Because one of the things is... I know I'm jumping around a lot here, but one of the things that happens in this is this idea of, you know, like, no, we're not just going to murder you in cold blood. It's not about this kind of, like, you know, Randian, we defeat our enemies, we take what is useful for them, we... Like, you know, part of the arc for Hobbs and Shaw is accepting each other as, you know, family and working together, restoring bonds with old family and lost ties. There's all that going on. So Idris Elba is a lost tie for Jason Statham. And so it's this whole, like, no, I'm not going to kill you. And what I was expecting was that his death would be, you know, the organization's attempt to take out those two, especially when they say stuff like, you know, ah, soldiers like this can't be turned. So I was expecting that he would fall off the cliff before the countdown and then explode at the bottom of the cliff and everyone would be like, oh, that's a redemption for that character. But, you know, that didn't happen. But there is an element of sadness and pathos to him that comes out in very few places. And I think those surgery scenes, because there's a sense of cruelty to that, because they're performing surgery on him and he's awake for that. You shouldn't be awake for surgery. That's, like, I think, like, a fear for a lot of people. And that's, like, something that is absolutely horrifying. So the fact that has to be awake for that, I feel like, given everything we know about them, that does feel like a deliberate cruelty.
Yeah, I mean, the whole organization is fascistic and eugenicist, right? Like, they are advocating for an Ubermensch type figure, which Brixton, like, fully inhabits that in some ways, and expects to be rewarded, expects to be trusted in the organization, and then in the end he ends up getting burned because he's been viewed as disposable this whole time. So yeah, it's this really fascinating villain character who has kind of bought into this ideology, thinking that it will benefit him in some way, and it ends up being weaponized against him and destroying him in the end. It's a very complicated villain character, I think.
I see. Okay. And I think, like, the last major one we want to talk about, and I will just mention offhand so we don't have to come back to it, Helen Mirren, absolutely charming as Queenie. I want her to escape. Okay? I want her to escape. So let's talk about Vanessa Kirby as Hattie.
Yeah.
How do we feel about her?
I have to say, I really genuinely enjoyed her in this movie. I know that we talked about her in terms of the last Mission Impossible film, where the role was really pretty problematic in terms of the storytelling. There are still problems in this story here, but I do have to say, I really enjoyed all of the stunts that she did. I think it was really pretty cool to see this skinny, like, blonde-haired English lady just utterly beating people up in fights and totally taking them down and stuff. I think her character is a lot of fun, and I like the interplay that she has with Jason Statham. So overall, yeah, I really kind of enjoyed Vanessa Kirby in this. What about you, Jess? What did you think of her role?
Yeah. I first of all, she's beautiful, and yeah, that look in the final fight where she's got, like, the overalls and the white shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Goals?
Yeah. Just
fucking
yeah.
Goals?
Totally.
There's also one of the assistant robbers in the Russian mob house.
Yeah.
Also has a similar look.
Yeah.
I have aesthetic needs.
Yeah, okay? That's real.
But I do really like her, and I like the dynamic to she. And there's a little bit of, like, kind of a weird thing I feel here, and
okay,
this is strange for me because I'm new to this whole girl thing, and
yeah,
seeing myself as a woman and seeing film through that lens.
Yeah,
and so I have it's weird because some of this has been boiling under the surface, some of this, and I kind of have a lot of doubt and second guessing when I want to make strong declarative statements like this, but I do feel like she does do a lot of good stuff where she is, like, taking charge and she's being an authentically strong and wonderful female character, but also the film is calling too much attention to it and trying to be like, see? Like, when The Rock talks to, like, when Hobbs talks to Shaw and he's like, you know, look, your sister consents to get all up on this hog. It's like, yeah, no, you can't be, like, woke and talk about how a woman has agency and then, like, have a guy talking to his brother about how he's gonna bang his sister. You know? It's a case of trying to have their cake and eating too, and it's very much, and it's, I have very complicated feelings about this because I think she is a great character from some, you know, feminist perspectives, but also the movie structure kind of folds in on her a little bit and does undermine that.
Well, and I think one of the issues with that particular sequence, too, is that she's being framed as this kind of, like, desirable object. And there's a lot of film critics who have already talked about this in many other films, but the use of white women love interests as this kind of, like, exceptional paragon of womanhood, or particularly, like, the idealized version of strong womanhood, ooh, that's a problem in there, too. So this is one of the things that I also think is really interesting about these movies, is that, again, they are trying to do this work of creating these new relationships with other people, exploring different dynamics related to race and gender and sexual orientation and stuff, but not always handling it well. Sometimes it's really messy, and in this case, like, yeah, this is a problem. Even as it's doing some good things, it's doing some things that are really not great, too.
Yeah. One thing I will say is she plays conviction very well. One of the recurring, and there's a lot of, like, kind of weird false starts, and I think the, like, I don't know, maybe this is just who I am as a film goer, but like, I often assume that things are going to happen in films that don't happen. I feel like dominoes are set up. Because she is very insistent on option one. She's like, there's no time, I have to die so that we can save the world. And I really like that about her. Because, like, she plays that very well. She has a very steely gaze when she does so. And I like that. I believe her when she says that. And one of the things I saw is when she's on the ground and the clock's about to complete and they're going to have the virus in the thing. One of the things I saw is, you know, she looks up at the helicopter and sees the fuel coming out of it. And what I thought was that she was going to threaten that, you know, oh, you know, she's covered in fuel. She's in like a pool of it. If you shoot me, you'll burn up the weapon anyways. That's what I was expecting to happen. Instead, it's like this, oh, you shoot it, and then it does a trail of fire up and right and down, and then it explodes right at the guy. And it's like, okay, that's not exactly what I was expecting.
It's not, and I will say that's another thing that happens in this franchise, too. There are audience fake-outs. There's just, like, straight-up red herrings. Like, they don't necessarily believe in Chekhov's gun. And I think that comes out sometimes in the way that the narrative plays out in the end. Because, yeah, I was also thinking, like, okay, is she going to threaten to self-immolate in that sequence as well? So,
okay, so that's not just me. Okay.
No, it's not. It's not. It's, that's kind of a thing in these movies.
Can I just say how much I love her outfits?
Her outfits are so great.
Yeah. No, when she comes out with the first disguise with the black wig, and it's just like, that's so good. I'm sorry. Like, this has been so weird for me as, like, a film goer. It's like, I've gone from, like, ah, I'm Doc, I'm a dude, I totally like ladies, that is an attractive lady who I would like to do things with. Now it's just like, I want to be her. And it's like, but also, like, I'm kind of gay. So it's also kind of like, but also, like, smooches. It's like, and she's just very pretty. And, like, and this is difficult for me because, like, the American standard of beauty in film, like, it's often, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl and all that. And so when she comes out with the dark hair, it's like, that is a degree of magnitude closer to something that I could achieve, naturalistically. So it's like, beautiful. Please, couldn't you just dye it dark for the whole film? That would have been great. But this is one thing I will say, going back to kind of like the faux wokeness or whatever, is I kind of don't mind her relationship with Hobbs, specifically because there's ambiguity left to it at the end. It's like, you know, they have one kiss. It says, we'll see if we get back to this in the morning, like when we come back, if we're still alive at the end of it. And then they never, there's no epilogue where it's like, and then I take you to Denny's to meet my daughter because we're totally boning now.
Oh, yeah, you know? No, they're definitely saving that for another movie.
I mean, they are. They're saving for a sequel, and it's kind of cheap in that regard, but I like that they can let that thread hang, whereas I feel like it's absolutely expected that they'd come back after the big battle and they'd have a passionate kiss, and then Shaw would look at them with disgust in his eyes, you know? And the fact that they don't have that actually is, I think, a good step. And this is a trend I think we're seeing in films where, like, maybe it's not necessarily coming about for the best reasons. I think this is coming out more of an idea of trying to avoid critical backlash and be like, oh, so the hero gets the girls, or the girl's just a trophy. And, like, I think studios want to avoid that accusation in reviews. But what we get, I think, as a byproduct of that, because, you know, like, intention versus consequence, is we get this idea where we're seeing a lot more films, and, like, we saw this in, like, Bumblebee, where relationships are allowed to not be explicitly sexual, or to be explicitly romantic, or to have ambiguity or room for, you know, future and potential, as opposed to being, ah, you kiss the girl, you... Because, like, how many movies have we seen where, like, the sequel has been like, oh, you ended up, you rode off into the sunset with a girl. Well, we didn't get her back for this movie, so you're going to have to spend an obligate scene talking about how you got divorced. Right? How many of those have we seen?
Oh, boy. So many. So many.
So, like, I'll give props to this film for doing that, even though I suspect in my heart of hearts that that was them doing that out of fear and not out of an active, like, political, sociological goal.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely true here. Although, I do want to also add that I think we can't fully discount the sort of, like, more subtle ways that actors and actresses in these films work against some of the archetypes that studios want them to embody. So for instance, in this movie, Idris Elba obviously has had a lot of press surrounding this whole, like, do we want him to be in James Bond or don't we? And the racist backlash from that was something to behold. Like, it's been a continuous issue for him ever since he was Heimdall. So in this movie, the line, I'm Black Superman, was originally actually supposed to be, I'm the Black James Bond. And at one point, Elba was just like, no, I'm not saying this line. I'm going to say something else. And I think that that line works a lot better because of that choice on his part. And so this is one of the things that I respect about this director in particular, is that he seems to allow actors to make choices that they feel are right for them. He's allowing them to set boundaries. He's not necessarily always forcing people to fit into this sort of, like, studio notes on what this film should be. And so that's the thing about this film, is that there's a kind of push-pull, and sometimes actors are able to assert creative agency over some of the choices that they can make. I also think that this is a particularly interesting role for Vanessa Kirby to take, especially after her role in The Crown, right, where she's playing the Queen's sister. I think this is a moment where she is trying to redefine herself as an actress, which is very hard to do when you've been cast in a period piece already. She probably doesn't want to be in that, and I think that's part of the reason why she's been in action films, and she's done very well for herself in these films. She's done very, very well on the stunts, and as well as a lot of the character work for this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated, it's a give and take, it's a dance, and, like, I don't think any of these, like, decisions or intentionalities can really exist in a vacuum.
Oh, no.
You know,
no,
like, we're still trying to do all this through the studio system. We're still trying to do everything with a history and a baggage and a cultural zeitgeist of the moment we're in right now. So, like, I guess props for trying? Like, I don't... It's hard to say where things happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we can answer where things happen. Partly because there's this big broad societal idea about the progress of history, right? And that's sort of been challenged for obvious reasons in the contemporary moment. It's not necessarily how things work, and it also doesn't adequately explain what's going on in these movies. I think what probably would help a bit more is Gramsci's idea of the war of position. So if you think about the studio system as a cultural hegemony, right? They have a hegemony over representation. They can determine who gets cast in movies, what types of characters there are, what types of stories they tell, what types of archetypes and stereotypes exist, all that stuff. And then you have a group, particularly artists of color and women artists, who have found inroads into this hegemonic system, who have been able to gain power and influence. And what they do with that power and influence is they attempt to create inroads for other people. They attempt to create a counter-hegemony or a counter-discourse against some of the things that are going on in the studio system. And you can really kind of see that in these films, right? You have two major producers of color who work on the Fast and the Furious franchise. You've got Vin Diesel and The Rock. And one of the amazing things about this film is that there were a ton of Samoan people, there were a ton of Maori people, and there were lots of Pacific Islanders who were included in this film as well. They don't tend to get a lot of representation, and so it's really cool that The Rock made a space for them. Now, it doesn't mean that the film perfectly handles that material. It doesn't. But what it does mean is that he's created a space. So it's just moving the bead slightly. And I think that's part of how I see this franchise and why I think it's so important.
Yeah, and part of it is also like, and this is maybe like my inner sociologist talking, but you can't construct a narrative from a single data point. And it's as we watch more films and as more films are made, and as we kind of examine the timeline of how things go, we start to see patterns. And one thing I see, like the connection I made between this and Bumblebee, is like I'm much more confident in my read of Bumblebee because of this film, because we're seeing that pattern repeat itself. And like, you know, twice is a coincidence, three times a pattern. So like, we'll see another one. But I feel like this has happened in other movies, even though I can't place it right now.
If you're talking about the sort of like ambiguity of some of the relationships again, that is a feature, not a bug, of a lot of the Fast and the Furious movies. And again, that's partly because these movies are so centered in the characters' relationships with one another and these ideas about like trust and loyalty and respect and all that stuff. I think that it's just kind of baked into the story structure of the Fast and the Furious franchise. So you do have these couples who have kind of like ambiguous relationships, whereas either will they, won't they, or this is probably not going to happen. But you don't know.
You know what I would love to see? I would love to see this become actually like the accepted standard and the expected outcome.
Yeah,
because
sure.
Here's something interesting that's going to happen is if you know, your standard boilerplate action movie has, you know, it has the girl still, but also, like, the relationship is left ambiguous and no one's guaranteed to get the girl at the end and so on. If we reach that era of film history, if that does happen, then what happens then is, as a side effect, if you as a director or a screenwriter do give a hero, you know, a kiss with a girl and, you know, like, I don't want to say trophy woman, but, you know, if you do invoke those, it'll actually mean something. It will be a creative decision and not something that the audience expects anyways, you know?
Yeah, and like I think some of this already exists, but it exists for certain artists. So Guillermo del Toro is a good example of this because he's known for using bodily contact in very specific ways in his films. In some films, people do not touch at all when they're in a romantic relationship or they don't kiss. Pacific Rim is noted for that. And so you do know that when he is using that sort of like touch or other forms of like contact, that it means something very specific for him. And while I know that's maybe not as mainstream a thing, it would be interesting to see other directors experimenting with that and thinking, I guess, more about what that means.
I'm curious to see if this bleeds into more newer franchises, because like we're looking at this media landscape where, you know, you've got the Fast and the Furious, you've got Transformers, you've got the MCU, and we're seeing this kind of thing happen more in these established franchises. The question is, when these dinosaurs fall, And they will.
Mm-hmm.
This cannot sustain forever.
Yeah.
What will happen with the next franchise? What will happen with the new franchise? And, like, maybe I'm being optimistic. Maybe I'm being idealistic in that I hope, you know, Disney won't take over and continue the MCU and be the only thing at the box office for the next 40 years.
Oh, Jess, don't even put that actually out in the universe. Don't even put that out there.
But, like, even if it's still Disney, like, Disney's still going to try new stuff. And, like,
Yeah. Maybe
this will become a standard. And, like, original properties or new films and, like, new franchises will pull this kind of thing off. Because I feel like it's a safe move when it's, like, you know, like, what is this, like, the eighth film in the franchise?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I do think that they have the room to make some of these choices. Like I said before about the war of position, part of what that affords people who are trying to create counter-hegemonies to do is to create those inroads, to create new ways of doing things that push back against, you know, established narratives. And I think that's definitely possible in franchises this.
I don't know, we got anything else to talk about? Because I feel like that's kind of it for this one.
Yeah, I think that's it for me.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll think of something. I will finish on this note, though. Eugenics is bad.
Yup.
Yeah. Anyways, this has been the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I've been your host, Jess Whitmore. You guys can follow me on Twitch and Twitter at Quasinym. That's Quasinym. And Annie, where can people find you and your stuff?
People can always find me on the Discord. I'm kind of a lurker of late, so if you see somebody reacting to your posts with emojis, that's probably me. Come hang out on the Discord. Come chat with us. We like to talk about movies, TV, video games, all that good stuff.
Yep. And as always, if you want to support us, first of all, you guys are listening. You guys are always just already doing that, and we love you. But we also have a Patreon at patreon.com/Quasinym, Quasinym, where you can actually get some bonus episodes that we've done way before everyone else, and it's a fun time. You know, we can talk about how Spider-Man is fucking, like, anti-capitalist as fuck. We love you guys. Tell a friend. Literally the best thing you can do. Spread us around, word of mouth. Help us out. But either way, thank you guys so much. Our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factopus. You can find a link to their EP in the show notes. And take care of yourselves, alright?
Bye. Bye.